I think if I were to classify Fincher in terms of how he thinks differently as a filmmaker, I see him as a kind of novelist, in a sense that I think that he has the entire story and how it looks laid out in his head. And the same way that when a novelist is writing, that they are plotting every moment, every second. They have to do, they have to describe the wallpaper in the atmosphere. They have to describe every little bit of it, and they have to have a voice, and they have to, and I'm also a fiction writer. So I have written a couple of novels, and hopefully one will get published one day, but it's a really, really difficult skill to master. So much more, I think, than screenwriting. So much more. And I see Fincher as a novelistic filmmaker in that sense, because I do think that he has a compartmentalized brain that can hold different things at the same time and can figure out the fact that, like, when he's doing coverage on, you know, like a table scene, that he needs to, like, make his day. So, like, maybe he's going to do like a muss ball or something so that he can light 360. Yeah. And that, that is also going to affect the color of the paint or the wallpaper behind him. And, you know, like these things that he's thinking about, like, simultaneously. And I see that as a novelistic way to think about things. And God, I love it. Everyone aspires to be that type of thinker, I think.
Welcome to Zodiac Chronicle, a 24-part investigation into David Fincher's 2007 genre-altering masterpiece, Zodiac. Adapted from Robert Graysmith's novel by the screenwriter James Vanderbilt, the film, of course, stars an incredible ensemble cast led by Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., Mark Ruffalo, Anthony Edwards, and John Carroll Lynch. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Our introduction today was former film critic at the LA Weekly and Village Voice turned filmmaker, screenwriter of Black Christmas, and former host of the Switchblade Sisters podcast, April Wolfe. Before we dive into the theme of the week in the show proper, I'd love to remind you to jump on and rate and review and hell, share the show wherever you're listening. It is a massive help for attracting people to our show, our brand of obsessive cinematic deep dives. I also want to let you know that the links to our Patreon with the weekly Rum and Rant podcast and special uncut Zodiac Sessions interviews, as well as links to our merch with artwork by the incredible Brianna Ashby and Amy Reid, who designed our show's pin, are in the show description or at oneheatminute.com. Joining me to rummage through the disgusting trailer of John Carroll Lynch's Arthur Lee Allen today are Zodiac screenwriter James Vanderbilt, online movie writing veteran, the founder of HitFix, film critic, screenwriter, industry analyst, the legendary Drew McWeeny, Los Angeles-based film critic and journalist for the Tribune News Service and Los Angeles Times, part-time lecturer at Chapman University, and the co-host of our own Miami Nice podcast, Katie Walsh, writer and film critic at the Film School Rejects, and guest on this week's Miami Nice, Anna Swanson, contributor for Film School Rejects and Stacker, movies intern at Paste, Brianna Ziegler, former long-running editor of Time Out New York, editor, critic, and writer for hire with bylines at the New York Times, Sight and Sound, Empire, and a true believer of all things Zodiac, the great Joshua Rothkopf, and finally some newcomers to Zodiac Chronicle, writer and director of The Trouble with the Truth, contributor to the American Cinematographer, historian, and the best screening moderator in LA and probably the greater US, Jim Hempel, art director, writer, and the creator of Cinephile, a card game, Corey Everett, and my dear friend, author of Fierce Bitches, Peckerwood, crime fiction aficionado, and author of noir literature, film, and culture blog, Hardboiled Wonderland, Jedediah Ayres. This is the 16th episode of Zodiac Chronicle, Leo Part 2. Every episode we've used a film title to encapsulate our theme. This sequence of the film shows the internal torment of doubt creeping in, as we see Toski wonder, did I believe Arthur Lee Allen was the Zodiac? Or did I just want him to be so this could all be over? So the theme of the week needs to encapsulate that self-doubt and maybe that second of temptation to step over the line. So this week's theme is insomnia. Thank you. We left off with mounting setback after frustrating inconclusion in the SFPD's investigation into Arthur Lee Allen. The brief sliver of silver lining revealed from Catherine, Lee's sister-in-law, opens a crack in the door and allows for a potential loophole to finally search the lair of this predator. Here's Corey Everett, Jed Ayers, and eventually James Vanderbilt talking about the gap in Finch's career between Panic Room and Zodiac, and about the astronomical expectations when David Fincher is returning to the genre of serial killers.
When I think about Zodiac, I think about the first time I saw it, and I think about what my relationship was to David Fincher and David Fincher's films at the time it came out. And looking back at both the film and his career from 2021, it's fascinating to see how much has changed since 2007. Where, you know, thinking about this in rewatching the film last night, I really see Zodiac as the turning point in his career between his more stylish music video 90s, Let Me Show You What I Can Do, you know, Thumbing My Nose at the System, Let Me Play Around with This Technology to Show You, a type of filmmaking, a type of storytelling that we haven't seen in feature filmmaking. You know, I'm going to take you through the barrel of this gun. I'm going to take you, you know, around the floors and in the air shaft of this house. I'm going to do things that have never been done on this scale. And then there's, between Panic Room and Zodiac, there's a 5-year gap, which was the longest in his career up until that point. And I think Fight Club was such a big deal for me and a lot of people as coming in that fall of 99, and where that was the year I started college, graduated from high school, started college 1999. And you know, I know there is a book about this from my buddy Brian Raftery, but, and you know, it's kind of commonly discussed, but I just remember in 99 going to the movies every week and so frequently having my mind blown by something. And so I really loved Seven. I liked The Game a lot. And Fight Club was, you know, as huge for me as it was at the time, and just one of the movies that really stuck out of a year that was just truly something special. I remember even being let down the next couple of years, even though I still loved movies, but it was like once I had hit that mountaintop of 99, where it was just like discovering new filmmakers and filmmakers kind of hitting their peaks or making new peaks. And it was just like this huge time of discovery for me, and that the next couple of years were a little bit of a letdown. I remember seeing Panic Room, you know, as this follow-up to Fight Club and liking it, but definitely being let down by, oh, okay, well, 3 years later, and like, this is what he's kind of devoted his time to. And I haven't revisited it in a while, but, you know, I remember it feeling like more of a, you know, a technical exercise and kind of a nasty little thriller and something where he could, you know, flex some of his filmmaking muscles, but wasn't necessarily trying to top what he had done before. You know, it felt like a throat clearing after Fight Club. And then 5 years passed, and that in filmmaking time, you know, as a director working is a long time. And so I remember the anticipation for me personally with Zodiac was huge, because in that 5 years, I remember kind of following the movie news, you know, through message boards and, you know, nascent, you know, internet and Ain't It Cool and whatever was going on, of just David Fincher is attached to Ad Astra. David Fincher is attached to, you know, Adapt Black Hole. David Fincher is attached to, you know, a dozen different projects that never happened.
Yes.
And then finally, David Fincher is going to make Zodiac. And, you know, I think for everybody who was a fan of his work, it was like, you know, Seven was a
he's coming high.
High point and he's an iconic. High. Yeah, exactly. It was an iconic 90s movie, and serial killers and David Fincher. It just goes together. Yeah. Peanut butter and jelly. And it was just like, I cannot wait for this. I cannot wait for this movie. And And then so I saw Zodiac. So it came out in March here in the United States, which is interesting now to think about the way you described it, you know, with There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men, which here were the kind of winter Oscar releases. That was November, December. And yeah. This was March. So this was spring. This was not Oscar time. This was not summer and not fall releases. And yeah. We're just going to put this out. And I think the studio, you know, for whatever reason, maybe they thought they weren't sure how it would do with audiences. They thought maybe March we can kind of sneak this out and turn a profit. But this yes. isn't an awards play. I don't know if they knew what they had. And so to think about the kind of David Fincher that we think of now as, well, if he makes a movie, it's going to be an awards contender. It's going to be yeah. Mank. It's going to be The Social Network. It's going to be, you know, which was just not at all what you would think about David Fincher pre-2007, you know, not at all. And so I remember seeing it, and I saw it at, there's a theater on the Upper West Side in Manhattan called Lincoln Square. It is an AMC, but it has this really beautiful, number one, I think it has the second largest IMAX screen in North America. And it also has this, what was called Theater One, or I think it was the Lowe's Theater at some point, which was this gigantic screen with a beautiful balcony and this kind of, you know, yeah. you know, ornate, you know, elephant design and curtains and all this stuff. And just didn't feel like a multiplex, even though it was in a multiplex. And so I remember seeing Zodiac opening night there and being extremely excited for it. And I remember liking the movie, but I remember walking out with a little bit of probably the feeling that most people of a kind of unresolved, you know, it's underwhelmed in that the ending is about as far away from the Seven ending as you can get in terms of here's the big bang, you know, it's all leading up to this. We are hurtling towards this finale and here you go. And this is not that.
I am not a feverish Fincher guy. And part of that is because I really expected to be early
yes.
on, you know,
yes.
when he, I really expected to be in the 90s. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I was anticipating Fight Club, you know, way more than a year out. You know, I already read the book. I was a big fan and I was excited that
Looks
he
great.
Was going to do it. And that was, and the movie came out and was amazing. I really thought Fincher's going to be my guy. Right. And,
yes.
And I don't think that he needs to be my guy. Like, I don't think that he let me down or something like that. Like, he's, you know, he's got a problem that he's not living up to. But it just is like, oh no, he turned out to be somebody else. You know, he'd done those crime films, Seven and The Game, I wasn't real hot on, but I really thought he was going to be my guy. And so I stopped going to see him theatrically after Panic Room. I'm remembering now that I was a little prejudiced against it too, because he was supposed to do, in that 5-year period is when I was getting super excited for his Black Dahlia.
Yes, Jed, I completely forgot about that until you said that.
Yeah, I was so excited because I was a huge James Ellroy fan, and I thought this is gonna be the he's my guy and this is going to be it. And he, you know, he moved on. I wasn't ready to move on. He moved on and he made this other, you know, serial killer movie that I wasn't as invested in, right off the bat. But, the other thing, honestly, that came in there though, is that I had two children in those,
you did.
5 years in between. So I did not, I did not go see many movies theatrically for several years. So,
yeah, I mean, we started with Lake Berryessa, and that's it. That was the first thing we shot. And I remember realizing too that David, I don't think, had made a film in 5 years too. So yeah. It was an interesting kind of, it was like he was working and did, but it was sort of, I think there was a nervousness about getting back on the horse too. And we were shooting digitally, which meant, which none of us, he had done it before, but none of us had really ever done before. Yes. He had to fight the studio to let them shoot digitally. I mean, that's how crazy it was back then. But it meant you could get in closer to the actors because the camera was much smaller. It meant you didn't need to have these huge lighting rigs. So it was this much more intimate kind of thing. And it was a smaller crew too, because you actually had to walk down to, you know, where that happened is a real walk down from the road. It's fairly inaccessible. Just shot it very simply. It's photographed very, you know, did it a bunch of times, but everybody was very serious about what they were doing. Everybody was, you know, again, knew that they were playing real people and then for me, I was just elated we were making it, because that movie was the first movie I worked on from the beginning to the end as the writer. I'd gotten a couple things made before, but I had always either been the person who sold the spec script and then was rewritten, or the person who came in at some other process. I'd never originated a project, gone with it to the end.
Met with Gray Smith to lobby for him to give you guys a shot at it. Yeah.
Like, yeah. And David had been very upfront and just said, you know, you're the writer. Like, I'm the director, you're the writer, he's the producer, we do our jobs. And, you know, so it was, I'd never gone all the way through. So just even getting this thing made that I had lived in my head for so long with this director, oh my God. And he was still capital D, capital F David Fincher back then too. Yeah. He was definitely, you know, the same way he is today. And so just actually shooting those days was sort of this crazy kind of magical thing. And then, and Richmond Arquette, I should say, played the Zodiac in that scene, who was lovely and wonderful. And then we went to San Francisco. We shot there for, I think, 2 or 3 days. Then we went to San Francisco and started with Jake and Mark. And I do remember the first scene they did was when Ruffalo comes out of the Hall of Justice, and Jake, it's late in the film, and Jake is sort of berating him, and he says, "Get away, I'm over this, I'm over you." And the first setup, he did 67 takes. And we went, and I think both Jake and Mark went, oh, okay, that I'm in this movie, okay.
And now, let's get to the scene.
Santa Rosa, where is he living?
In his trailer.
Santa Rosa?
Sonoma County. You wouldn't have to go through the Vallejo DA.
It's been 11 months since you talked to this guy, and now you want to search his trailer.
If we find something, great. If not, we get his prints and handwriting samples from both hands.
That sure would shut you down.
What if I can get a second opinion?
I don't want to step on Sherwood's toes. He didn't train me
at this. All I need to know is, if the suspect is ambidextrous, could he possibly have written those letters with his other hand?
Between you and me, because there are differing schools of thought on this. Get the samples of his other hand. If he's the Zodiac, you'll get a match.
That's the current thinking, according to Terry Pascoe. Meanwhile, I spoke to a psychologist who'd be willing to testify that someone who undergoes a personality change like Zodiac would manifest it physically, altering his handwriting.
Which is why Sherwood couldn't get a match for mail-in samples. We got Terry Pascoe, the psychology guy, coupled with Chaney. It could be enough for a warrant.
Get Chaney on the record.
And shoot the kiddies as they came bouncing out. And that he would call himself Zodiac.
Yes.
And you're willing to swear to this under oath in Superior Court?
Without any hesitation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chaney. Thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you.
Well, looks like you got your man.
Now, I can't be sure, but that line, "looks like you just got your man," sounds a lot like David Fincher. It actually sounds like the man himself, putting on a little bit of a voice. Now, in this credible, tense battle, lobbying for an alternate route to legitimately investigate Arthur Lee Allen, we see wrestling for second opinions, tiptoeing into new jurisdictional areas to lobby, finding the right things to be said to a judge to allow them to finally search this man's trailer 11 months after the interview. So to help me unpack the fastidious pacing of Zodiac, the reason why jurisdiction and these specifics of investigations matter, the fact that these are real people, and convincing producers and financiers that these are the ways that one should conduct themselves when making a true-to-life text, I've got a lineup of incredible people. Anna Swanson, writer of Zodiac, James Vanderbilt, April Wolfe, and finally Josh Rothkopf, who summarizes that this scene is all about how drastically ill-equipped 1970s policing was for serial killers.
I think it's just, it's to me, and yeah, I get why, like, for some people this is not Fincher's most, like, watchable. It's I mean, it's not the one that I've watched most, you know, but, like, I watch his stuff a lot. I love the guy. And I get, like, it's sort of, it has this sort of pace that it's working with that I think it's weird to call it slow, because I feel like slow is so often used to, like, disparage a film, like, oh, it's slow, it's boring, but it's not. It's just, like, purposefully slow and meditative because it's about process. And I think you're either gonna be engrossed by that or you're not. And for some people, like, slow isn't their vibe, and, like, I get it, but I think for me it's just, it's how richly detailed any given scene can be.
Yes.
Even when on the surface what is happening is fairly straightforward. So I think that anyone who goes into the film with, like, even just that tidbit of knowledge, maybe they don't know all the details, they don't know, you know, how expansive this was, they don't know what time period everything took place in, right? Like, you know, Zodiac's never solved. So I think that whereas something like Gone Girl or Seven or The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, there's the thrust of an investigation that you kind of, you either assume if you're watching for the first time, or you know if you're watching on repeated viewings, that this is going to be solved. There's going to be a conclusion here. We're going to find out who did it. And yes, there's twists within that. Of course, like Seven, obviously, like, great twist, even when you know who did it, right? That type of thing. But I think that with Zodiac, it kind of, if you go into the movie with any knowledge, I think you have to be aware, or at least come to learn very quickly, that the thrill of this movie is sitting in these scenes where we know we're not going to solve the case, but it's about the obsession and the process and the minutia of trying to figure it out. And I just think, like, even when working in that sort of serial killer investigation genre, like, it's so varied and it's so different.
I was sort of obsessed with the idea of, you know, the more research I did on, the more we sort of talked to the police of, like, how that actually worked. And not only it's like, people make mistakes, people, you know what I mean? First guy on the crime scene, you know, bundled everything into a blanket, you know? You know, Toski never found out that Darlene knew a guy named Lee, because that wasn't his case. Paul Stein was his case. So it's sort of, you kind of, and also sort of pop culture, when you see movies and TV shows about cops, 99% of the time, they know everything, right? They know all the facts of the case. They know, you know, jurisdiction doesn't matter. You know what I mean? And so it was really interesting to go, oh, jurisdiction really matters. Like, jurisdiction really, like, when Graysmith talks to Toski and says, you know, Darlene this, Darlene that, and he goes, yeah, that's not my case. Paul Stein's my case. Like, that's a real thing. You know, it's a real thing they had to deal with. So we love the stuff about, I love the stuff about who is a fax machine and who doesn't have a fax machine. Like, that to me is great shit, you know, to be able to put into this, because it's the stuff you don't consider when you go, how did they never catch this master criminal? Well, A, maybe he wasn't a master criminal. And B, the reason he didn't catch him is because it's really hard to do all of this stuff, you know? It's really hard to communicate information between four different police departments. That doesn't mean that one cop was dumb or another cop, you know, but it just, time goes on, people lose their, you know, people's memories change, they lose evidence, they forget stuff. Like, you know, time is the real killer of all of these things. So that stuff was really interesting to me, to sort of, to be able to explore that. Well, that's what I mean, and that's also why we put Summer of Love in the beginning of the movie. It was very, you know, it's like, no, this was July 4th, 1969. You know, it starts with the most Americana of Americana, the fireworks and, you know, sparklers and kids and the summer of love. And that was all very, very deliberate. And then with the Brian Hartnell piece, I mean, I remember sitting with Fincher and Brian Hartnell and Brad with the police report, Ken Narlow's police report. And we went through it with him and he would say, oh no, I remember that. Yes, I did do that. Yes. Oh no, I think that's wrong. I was wrong about that. And sort of went down every kind of line and beat. And he had given his statement from the hospital bed. I mean, been stabbed, yeah. I think, the day before. So he was on drugs, he was in and out of it. And so a lot of what we were doing was, and Fincher was very serious about this from the jump. He said, we have to get this right because these are real people. You know what, yes. I mean? I'm showing real people die on screen who had families who are probably not gonna be excited there's a movie about this. We have to be as accurate as possible. And so that's why, you know, he set these, I'm sure you've heard this, but he sort of famously with us set these conditions, which were, we have to use everybody's name, correct name. We can't use pseudonyms. We have to talk to every living survivor. And we have to be journalistically as accurate as possible. And I actually, in the script, had to double source everything like a journalist for us to put in the movie. Because that's also the legal department was like, you want to use everyone's real name?
That's the kind of stuff that I love. And also one of the reasons why the commentary tracks for his movies, I think, are some of the best, film school that yeah. you can get. The ways that he's thinking about things is the kind of stuff that you're not actually going to get in film school. Like he's creating things to think about in film school. I think also something about him, another aspect of filmmaking is like, this is amazing. It's creative. I think about this in terms of like Peter Weir, Cronenberg, all of these other people who've like broke ground and how they make film. You have to convince people that this insane idea that you have is worth putting that work into. And yes. it's not always the case with crews that you hire. It's not always the case that you can convince them that this is the way that it should be done, because people come out of, for instance, film school. Sometimes they're just like union who've been around for a long time and they don't want to do something different. And that's a hurdle that you have to get over, is the fact that you have to convince all of these people around you who've done things a certain way that you should actually do them your way. And that it's worth the time, because it yes. will take extra time. And so many people do not feel that it's worth the time, especially when there's a producer who's just like, are you going to make your day? And, you know, of course you can plan as much as you can and like try to get people to understand that this is your vision and that you have to, you know, put in this extra effort. But it's not easy. It's really not. And it's a separate art form to get people to listen to you when you say that you have to do things a different way, to unlearn it. I mean, like that, your natural reaction is like, you're on set, you're just like, I know how to do my job. Why would someone tell me how to do my job? And it's just like, well, sometimes you can learn how to do your job differently. And that's just, I think, sometimes condescending to people too. Yes. But at the end of the day, it could kind of open up their creative floodgates. And that's why you get someone like Cronenberg, who only works with the same crew all the time. It's just like, yeah, we know we're going to do something different on set.
Zodiac is, in a way, about the clutter of departments not meshing well.
Yes.
There's a whole scene in the film about faxes that didn't reach the right
place. We don't have a fax either.
We don't have a fax, right. There's a very subtle kind of like envy and also kind of a snobbery in there. And yeah. Right? And it's kind of about, I mean, this has been much discussed, the idea of the film being about an analog information age
yes.
that doesn't have, but it's, I think it's not necessarily the analog solidity. It's the fact that there are these little communities and little worlds and little perfectly functioning police departments that work well, and deputies in small towns and even in big cities. But the idea of tracking an overarching crime spree like this over several years and several towns and
different modes almost always.
That was a kind of crime that didn't exist.
Yes.
And when you think about like why something like the FBI was created, In a way, this is sort of like what Michael Mann's Public Enemies is about too, but like the idea of what the FBI signified in terms of like larger international crimes and crimes that needed a sort of a larger governmental oversight to really get at it. People weren't associating serial killer crimes with that. They're very proud of Dillinger, yeah, and bank robbers and the or
gambling or mafia,
gambling or counterfeiters like yeah. Abagnale and Catch Me If You Can, but like the idea of serial killer crime, or especially sexual serial killer crime, gruesome, like that wouldn't have risen to the occasion of a sort of a national oversight level, which I think places this movie at a really interesting moment in just crime, you know, pursuit. I mean,
yes,
it's fascinating to me, and in a way it kind of harkens back all the way to a movie like M, which I know is a film that Fincher loves, Fritz Lang's M, where it still continues to blow my mind when I watch that movie about how it's the criminals that get together and catch the killer. I'm sorry, spoiler alert, but it's like the idea that this is way too complicated for the, you know, police and his, you know, cup of coffee and his, you know, his cozy little office with the, you know, it's an archetype, and it's sort of like, you know, Mabuse and, you know, yeah, Dr. No, and the whole idea of the criminal mastermind. But it really was, I mean, in a real world sense. And actually, it's funny when you think about it, like there's also a through line in Zodiac, in addition to the through line of police departments working together or not working together. There's another through line of the heroic cop, you know, Toski as the model for Bullet. And Bullet stole that holster thing from Toski, not the other way around. And that's something that we hear from Avery, like Fincher needs to include that line to talk about how, so we're still almost trapped, if you think about it almost in a larger sense, we're trapped in a kind of a John Wayne mentality of, yes, the heroic cop, or, you know, Clint Eastwood to be more current with the time of Zodiac, who's gonna come in and fix it, get Scorpio, whatever. But that's just simply not what's gonna happen in reality.
Well, looks like you got your man.
Mr. Allen, this is the Santa Rosa Police Department. We have a warrant to search your residence. Hello?
I'll check with the neighbors.
Close the door.
Close it out. There's rodents running around.
Neighbor said he tore out of here about half hour ago. You think somebody tipped him?
We're not leaving till he comes back.
I'll check the back.
Jesus.
What?
Squirrels. Piece of work, this guy.
Whoa, not one but two blue windbreakers.
Like the Stein scene.
We'll have those checked for blood.
And a pair of black gloves. Men's seven, just like the ones we found in the cab. Well, he's got the same size shoes and gloves as he. Probably just a coincidence.
Dave, I got a gun. Check that. Two guns. They're both 22s, one automatic, one revolver.
That's interesting. Because he happens to have an M1 rifle here in the closet.
The little darling's bouncing off buses.
Someone's here.
Hello, Arthur. Remember us?
When we arrive at Arthur Lee Allen's trailer, we're set up for that mythical John Doe moment, just like Seven. Seven is ultimately a film that explores the aftermath and the detritus of heinous acts. Breaching the seal on that maze-like manifestation of John Doe's mind reveals shrines dedicated to each perfectly conceived perversion, cataloguing a truly unfathomable level of psychopathic dedication. In complete contrast, the corner block, weathered trailer of Arthur Lee Allen opens to reveal a grotesque, slovenly hovel, distractingly filled with rodent life in all stages of animation. Pornography is strewn in the living spaces, self-pleasure apparatuses are discarded in grotty bedside gutters, a scum-filled bathroom carelessly utilized. This is not the lair of a master criminal. And it's impossible to imagine that the traces of crimes that altered the consciousness of San Francisco and Southern California would not be able to be found in such a squalid mess of this most appealing suspect. But that's just it. 11 months is a long time. Here's Drew McWeeny, Katie Walsh, and Jim Hempel on casting John Carroll Lynch and all the feelings that you get when you watch this trailer scene.
I'm fascinated at how well he plays off of them, at how well he bats things away. And, you know, if he's not guilty, if we look at the rest of the film, the scene that we're talking about, the Charles Fleischer scene, that scene, I don't think that guy had anything to do with it. I don't think ultimately that guy was responsible for anything or tied to anything. But not knowing lends so much fear and so much weight to that. And not knowing in John Carroll Lynch's scene, I don't know how you walk into any of those rooms, even with four or five other guys, like, because you've got him built up as the devil in your head by that point. And I do think the way that the film manages to show you how they felt like he was the this guy. Giant, terrifying thing, but the film never leans into it to make us see him that way. Yes. That's another trick that it's constantly playing. It doesn't give him the satisfaction, you know, on the off chance the Zodiac Killer is still alive and holding office as Ted Cruz and watching this film, you know, he's not going to watch this and go, yeah, they really made me look good there. Like, it's not a celebratory movie at all. And that's not, it's such a balancing act, man.
So it's such a relief to be able to modulate this terror and tension that is like permeating an entire city and this edging quality of the investigation that goes nowhere. And it's this weird labyrinth that like everybody's falling down, and then having these little funny moments along with it and these little moments to breathe and kind of sort of say life goes on and people are still going to say funny things and people are still going to get drunk and people are still going to fall in love and people are still going to, like, you know, as much as they are obsessed with these things. And I think that's, you know, going back to Memories of Murder, like, that's the same thing. It's like, these cops are still people. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to do stupid stuff, get drunk. They're going to go to the weird spa. They're going to, you know, fight with each other. And like, it's that human quality. And so there's this like humanity in both the investigators and we don't get it so much. I mean, we kind of get it with the Zodiac because it's like he's this mythological figure, but we see Arthur Lee Allen and we realize he's just a guy. And there's something about going to his trailer when you're just like, this place is disgusting. Like, yeah, this is the mind really of a disturbed individual. Like, are there like a bunch of squirrels?
Squirrels living in there and also frozen for the purposes of eating, I guess, as well as like sex toys and
yeah,
guns
and yeah, filth. The guns and filth and that kind of brings him back down to earth a little bit too. I mean, it's disturbing, but it also is like, just like, here's this very weird, strange, disturbing existence of this person. And, you know, I think Fincher's really trying to grapple with the outsize legend and the human scale of it all with all of these different people. And, you know, Toski's kind of a legend and he's Bullet and he's Dirty Harry and the Zodiac is a legend, but like, who are they really as people? Like, Toski loves animal crackers and, you know, he loves sandwiches, like, or just what, all of the little quirks and things that Ruffalo brings to the performance. So I think that like modulation between like the legend and the real people involved is like what really makes it work.
That's always something that struck me as interesting about the end of that trailer search scene, is that you don't, if my memory is correct, you don't actually get a reaction shot from John Carroll Lynch. You just see him from behind. And it's such an interesting choice of Fincher's. And yet you don't need to see him because John Carroll Lynch made such an indelible impression during his interview scene. You know how he's reacting. You can imagine his reaction. It's almost like, you know, it's just, I feel like that's always a testament to a great actor, is when you can see them from their back and know what they're thinking. And that's sort of a great classic example of it.
I love that too, because you already know the games that he's willing to play to seem put upon. And it's almost like, how could it ever get better than what we've just seen? How could it ever get better than that great scene? So him being there and then being at the trailer and him pretending and having this lovely facade and then people being in his space, that incredible transition, I think John Carroll Lynch himself called back, you know, peeling off his human skin suit to react to react to the what was happening. I love that choice. And I also love, he's wearing terrible shorts, Jim.
Yeah, yeah. The wardrobe disgusting. Choice is really fascinating.
Yeah, it's great. Just disgusting high shorts. He's not a very, you know, he's not a very spry and svelte man at that moment. Like, he's meant to be a bit dumpy to fit with the brief of Zodiac. So it's really, it's a really fascinating choice. And I love that. I love that look.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's based in any kind of research or if it was just a creative choice or what, because I remember reading an interview with Fincher around the time the movie came out where he talked about his approach to the wardrobe and the costumes and how it was always this thing where they would have something that kind of, you know, looked right in terms of the visual design, but then they would discover that someone, you know, would wear a t-shirt over a shirt and tie, and they would be like, well, that's a strange choice, but that says something about that person. And so then, you know, Fincher's tendency would be to use the thing they discovered in the research. And I don't know if that's where that Arthur Lee Allen shorts choice comes from or where, but it is, yeah, it's very odd. And I love that thing about peeling the skin off, because that's what he does in the final scene you see him in with Gyllenhaal in the hardware store too. There's just that great moment where they lock eyes and John Carroll Lynch, it's so subtle. I mean, that's the great thing. I know other people have talked about this in the podcast, but the acting in this movie, it is so subtle. I can't figure out exactly how the actors even do it. And I mean, it's just, I don't know. Obviously the movie, you know, the movie's really brilliantly cast and it's brilliantly written and it's really well directed by Fincher, and there's just something about the alchemy of all those elements coming together that you get those moments, you know, again in that Arthur Lee Allen interview scene that you've talked about on the previous episode, just the subtle ways that the investigators give away to each other and talk to the audience what they're thinking while trying to contain it from Arthur Lee Allen. It's such subtle, complex acting. And, you know, I mean, there's some movies that I watch that are great and I have a sense of how they did it. I know how they got their effects. And then there are some where it's just a mystery to me. And this is one of those movies where it's just a mystery, because it's, in so many ways, the movie is so conventional when you get right down to it. You know, in so many ways, it's just, it's what you see on procedurals every week on multiple shows. I mean, even that, the trailer scene, when they are searching the trailer, there are certain aspects of it, they're like serial killer movie 101. I mean, seeing like, you know, the squirrel, the rodents in like cages and in the refrigerator, and the filthy, obscure porno magazines, and just the way it's lit and the way it's framed. It's not that different from an episode of Criminal Minds, but the subtle ways in which it is different make it totally different from an episode of Criminal Minds.
Do you remember us? Just a deft, antagonistic jibe from Toski to build the possibility that we've finally caught this guy. Now, if the Zodiac and Manson were hinge points in American consciousness. This is the hinge point in Zodiac. We transition back to the SFPD, and Toski and Armstrong are almost jumping out of their skin, watching Captain Marty Lee debriefing on the phone. Fincher and Harry Savides compose one of the most impactful shots of the film. Dermot Mulroney walks from the office of Captain Marty Lee toward the camera. He's out of focus in the background and moves into a sharp close-up. He speaks a word that is impossible to unhear, and for every single viewing from this point onward, you know he's going to say.
Ballistics, no match. Prints, no match. Writing, no match.
On both hands, right? Because we got handwriting from both his hands.
And neither hand matches.
Forget Sherwood. Let's get another opinion.
Fellas, he's not your guy.
Here's Brianna Ziegler summing up something that I think that Toski is feeling in this moment and that we are feeling at the conclusion of this scene every single time you watch it.
And I had another moment where I was just like, I had multiple moments during my rewatch last night where I was like, I would love, like, a few years down the line, we have another like Golden State Killer moment where suddenly it's like, we got him, we got him, we figured it out. Like, all, but I don't think we will. No. I maintain that it was Lee Allen. And I mean, especially with the fact that the letter stopped after he died. And I mean, it's as if it was him, as long as he's dead, like nothing's ever gonna happen again. And everyone will still think Ted Cruz is the Zodiac killer. Yeah, I was like, nah, we're never gonna have that Golden State Killer moment. Cause if it really, if I get to live to old age and nothing about the Zodiac killer ever comes back again, I will die. And my last thought will be, it was her.
Hey, what do you want? Time off? A hug?
You know what the worst part of this is? I can't tell if I wanted it to be Alan so bad because I actually thought it was him, or I just wanted all this to be over.
It's because you thought it was him. And I did too. You know what? Take some time off. Spend some time with your wife and the kids. Go to Candlestick. See a movie.
And now the final word on this episode of Zodiac Chronicle, firstly from April Wolf about the structure of Zodiac, and finally from Fincher's style, from Josh Rothkopf.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I do want to say that one of the reasons I feel like this didn't get appreciated, I mean, of course, like the length, but Fincher's employing basically a two-act structure to this. Yes. And I think a two-act structure terrifies people. It doesn't make them feel comfortable in the same way that a traditional three act does. And you know, Kubrick would constantly do a two act structure. Hitchcock would sometimes do a two act structure, but that's more of like a classic filmmaking technique. That's something Yes. that we've completely moved away from. And so he's bringing in these classic techniques that fall out of favor. And I find that he's employing them in more modern ways that people have to learn the language of his filmmaking a little bit more. And so then you get in the TV show of like Mindhunter, which, you know, TV now and streaming can be more experimental, and people are like, oh, I love that, I want more of that. And it's like, hey, have you heard of Zodiac? So you know, I did yeah, want to
the suggested viewing is actually just Zodiac underneath Mindhunter. If you like Mindhunter, it's look at what we've made you before, like 10 years ago.
Exactly. It's just like, hey, we've actually done this. It's totally fine if you just want to revisit it now. And I would love to see more people employing more classic film techniques and structures like David Fincher's doing in this, even though it wasn't successful then. Like, you can't really use it as a comp as a filmmaker, which is the sad part, because like, you fall in love with something and you wish that it were more popular and you want to use it as a comp when you're doing pitches, and people are like, yeah, that movie didn't make any money, and you're like, well, shit, so I'm gonna do something that will make money. But it, this is like, anyway,
Fincher isn't necessarily about the content for me at this point. Like, it's really about, I mean, he was one of the first filmmakers for me to realize about his filmmaking, that he was going to excite the material based on his own technique, not necessarily based on a revelation or like, oh, they're closing in on the killer or something. And in a way, for me, Fincher then joins a lineage of people like Pakula, but also people like Dario Argento.
Yes.
Where you're talking about giallo films that just have the stupidest content, like really the stupidest. If you describe it, the killer likes to wear black gloves, or, you know, he's, you know, like, if you describe it out loud, it'll crumple, it'll fall apart. But if you watch it and you realize that
Mario like, Bava.
Bava, exactly.
Like
there you go. And it's all like craft, and it's he's directing the shit out of it. He's directing the shit out of shit. Yeah. It's marvelous, and it's also exciting me to think or speculate there must have been a meeting where Fincher is persuading people to give him money to make Zodiac, and they're saying, well, it won't have an ending because we don't know who the Zodiac killer is. He'll say, no one's going to care. No one's going to care, because by the time they've watched my movie and you've seen my movies, they will be so thrilled and so excited that no one's going to care. I don't even know if he's 100% right about the conviction, but I love the fact that he must have had that conversation with the people before they greenlit the film. You know.
That concludes episode 16 of Zodiac Chronicle, Leo, part 2. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to subscribe to this show so you're the first to know about all upcoming episodes. And if you can't get enough, Unplugged Zodiac sessions are going to be available exclusively on the One Heat Minute Patreon, which is linked in all of our show notes or at oneheatminute.com. This episode of Zodiac Chronicle was researched, written, and presented by me, Blake Howard. The music of Zodiac Chronicle is composed, produced, and performed by Chris Duffy of Los Espinas. Thank you, Duff. Our companion, I Am Not Avery, Zodiac stickers and pins were designed by the extremely talented Amy Reed, who you can find on Instagram at ai.me.me. or via email at amy.reed0310@gmail.com. And go buy one, why don't you? They're very cheap and they're very awesome. So until next time.
Goodbye.